The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Kathleen Dougherty. I work here at Parkway Central, and I'm a big fan of our guest this afternoon and excited to introduce her. But before we get started, if I could ask you to turn off your cell phones, and I'd also like to remind you that there will be a book signing upstairs in the lobby immediately following the lecture. The Free Library is really pleased to host Amy Goodman on her Breaking the Sound Barrier book tour. There are a lot of synergies and common values between public libraries and independent media. We both provide the information and the tools that are so essential to support real democracy and ensure that everyone has a voice in the political process. Amy Goodman has been an important voice in independent media for more than 30 years. As the award-winning host of the radio and television show Democracy Now!, now on 800 stations internationally, she offers an alternative to the sound bites and rantings of the pundits that so dominate our mainstream media. She also co-authored three previous books with her brother, David Goodman, and is the recipient of dozens of awards, including the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award and the George Polk Award. Her latest book, Breaking the Sound Barrier, offers a collection of essays from her column of the same name. From war and torture to climate change and health care, Amy Goodman tackles the important issues that threaten our democracy and undermine our human rights. She is also passionate about the fight for independent media, which is a continuous struggle. In fact, just last week, she was detained at the Canadian border, where she was questioned about what she planned to say at her appearance at the Vancouver Public Library, and her colleagues' laptops and their other material was searched. And yes, I did say the Canadian border. Please join me in welcoming a strong advocate of dissent and a tireless and fearless champion of independent media, the unstoppable Amy Goodman.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for that introduction. Maybe I'll start off right where you left off. With what has been happening with this sort of mini tour that we did, sort of truncated on both sides, and I'll, this side is that we're leaving for Copenhagen on Friday to cover the climate change summit that will be taking place. So you can expect in the next few weeks that Democracy Now! Every day will be broadcasting live from Copenhagen. How many of you watch on Mind TV? What used to be WYVE, wonderful. 35.1 every evening at 7:30, 35.2 mornings 8, noon, and 7 p.m., or mindtv.org. How many of you watch on DUTV? That's channel 54 and 62. That's live every morning at 8, then repeated noon, 7. WPBEB. 88.1 FM, Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Anyway, you all got these flyers, and you can take gobs of them give them out everywhere so people know where they can find independent media here in Philadelphia. And it's wonderful to see Nikki Smurl, who is our old community organizer, Democracy Now! Outreach coordinator, who is here giving out flyers. And a special thanks to Brenda Murad, who works with me at Democracy Now! And has been traveling with me. And a shout out to my aunt and uncle, Addie and Marsh, who are here. Where are you? I thought they were here, but I know they are. There they are. It's wonderful. And Vivian, to have family here. So, okay, I'll start there. Just a few days ago. See, this tour, a mini tour of about 30 cities in 2 weeks. And it was the day before Thanksgiving. And we thought, what can we do for the Thanksgiving holidays when everyone here is eating turkey? Well, maybe we could go north of the border and talk turkey in Canada. And so we started that day on the busiest travel day of the year in SeaTac Airport. That's Seattle-Tacoma Airport. And they have one of the largest borders in their airport, and they thought this was an extremely novel idea. I credit Dennis Moynihan, who is the editor of every single week's column that is called Breaking the Sound Barrier, just like the whole book is, for encouraging me to take on the column 3 years ago. It's distributed by King Features, which is Hearst. And when they approached me, I really did think it was a good idea to reach out into the mainstream media, to do a column every week in the op-ed pages of the major newspapers of this country. And they're in more, it's in more than 100 papers. You can ask the Philadelphia Inquirer or any other newspaper locally to run it, to encourage a robust debate around the critical issues of the day. That's the point of these pages, the op-ed pages. You know, today, if you got to hear or watch Democracy Now! Already, we interviewed the editor of Extra, the magazine for fairness and accuracy in reporting, fair.org, and they looked at the last 10 months of the two major newspapers in this country, the New York Times and the Washington Post. And they looked at the articles on their, the editorials, the op-ed pieces in their papers. You know, as we're about to hear tonight, President Obama's address at West Point, where he will announce an escalation of war in Afghanistan, which is quite stunning considering in next week he is headed to Oslo to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. Also, the Peace Prize coming just about the time the State Department perhaps inadvertently said that the U.S., rare in the countries of the world, will not sign the Landmine Ban Treaty. It's interesting to look at these op-ed pages because in the last 10 months, though 59% of Americans believe that we should end the war in Afghanistan, not escalate it, compare that around 60% to the 12 or 13% of articles on these op-ed pages that present an anti-war point of view. I think almost all or every one in the New York Times was one writer, Bob Herbert. I mean, this is not representing the spectrum of opinion in this country. The Washington Post, the spectrum of debate, and the Times most often is, they do have debates. How exactly should we conduct this war is the spectrum of the debate. Well, you know, it goes much further than that. And it's not just the newspapers of this country. It's the networks, and it's a very big problem. FAIR also did a study in the weeks leading up to the Iraq war of the four major nightly newscasts, NBC, ABC, CBS, PBS, NewsHour, that month before the U.S. invaded Iraq. And they found in the two-week period around Colin Powell giving his push for war at the U.N., there were 393 interviews done around war on the four major nightly newscasts. Guess how many were with anti-war leaders? Three of almost 400. It's no longer, I mean, that is not a mainstream media. That's an extreme media beating the drums for war. Because I do think those who are opposed to war, those who are opposed to torture, those who believe health care should be a right, those who are deeply concerned about global warming are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back. But so there we were at Borders in the Seattle airport. And they just thought this was very unique. This is also Dennis Moynihan's idea, coming up with these ingenious ways to do outreach. Because when you're sitting in the middle of an airport, you're going to meet people that didn't expect to stumble over you. And stumble they did. I mean, this was a unique experience for me because I don't think I have ever sat down in an airport before. I am the one who's usually hurling through the airport and hurtling my body against a door that already has been closed, begging the flight attendants to open the door, bring that plane back. I'm the one that you really probably don't like. And there I was. The airport was no longer a way to get somewhere for me, but a destination. I was sitting in the airport. And the Borders had set up a display of the books. And I was signing. And it was so interesting to meet the people who happened to be walking by. Like a Alaska Airlines flight attendant, her boyfriend had called her from Los Angeles and said, go over to Borders, because he was a fan of Democracy Now. Or the farmer from the border with Canada who listens to a little community radio station there called The Root, KTRT. And he had me sign a book to the founder of this radio station. And then there was the woman who came from Bellingham, Washington. We had just spoken in Bellingham the night before. And she hadn't been to the talk because she was preparing for this journey she was going to take. It was one she thought about every day of her life for the last 40 years. She was going back to Vietnam. She had been a nurse 40 years ago. She'd actually worked in a leprosarium. I'd never even heard that word, right? A hospital for lepers. And she was going back to Vietnam to apologize. She said she had thought long and hard about this, to apologize for the war. So it was just such a unique journey. And also, okay, so there was a little competition involved here. Because, well, we were set up on this side of the entrance to Borders. And on the other side was this big display of Sarah Palin's book, Going Rogue, right? So first it was the student from College of Puget Sound. She ran up, she had signed two books for my father and for my sister, and I did. 2-0. So then the farmer came up to me. Oh, he also got one for himself. 4-0. Now the employees at Borders were sort of getting into this. They were intrigued. This is not supposed to be what was going to happen. The person who was going to Vietnam, she was, had a long trip, so a long book of columns was one she would be interested in. And that's how it went. Now, Media Bistro got involved because they are a website for publishers and books that have come out. So they were checking in. How is it going? Okay, so I explained. We were up to like 40-0. And I just whispered into the phone, going rogue is going nowhere. Now, I'm not really in direct competition, although I do want to say we just hit the New York Times bestseller list, which I am shocked by. But just for you to understand how publishing works, we're not exactly in direct competition because books are put into categories. And Breaking the Sound Barrier, my book, is nonfiction. So we headed from Borders to the border, to Canada. I was headed that night to another wonderful library, the Vancouver Public Library, and I was going to be giving a speech at 7 o'clock. So we timed it. It was about 6 o'clock. We were going over the border, plenty of time to get there. And we handed in our passports, the routine, and they flagged us. They told us to pull over. Large hangar facility for the Douglas border crossing there. Pouring rain. They told us to get inside. And there they started, well, outside. They were going through the car. And then they called me up to the counter, and the Border Patrol were there, you know, fully armed, and they said, Amy, we want your notes. I said, excuse me? No. Anyone who knows me knows I don't exactly read a script at my speeches, but we want your notes now. Notes for what? Notes for your lecture tonight. I said, at the Vancouver Library? That's right. Hand them over now. I was very surprised. Now it's getting late, and I'm already late for the talk. But I went out to the car and looked around and got a copy of Breaking the Sound Barrier and brought it in. I don't usually like these books that have the picture of the author, but this one helped me on the border, right? So it establishes who I am. I hand it to him. And I said, actually, I just read columns from the book, and then I sort of extemporaneously speak about them. And he said, I want the notes. I said, no, consider the book my notes. What are you going to talk about tonight then? I said, well, actually, I'll start with the last column in the book. And it's the column about Tommy Douglas. considered the greatest Canadian. He was the premier of Saskatchewan, and he was the one who pioneered the Canadian National Health System. In fact, we're at the Douglas border crossing. What else are you talking about? Well, I was going to talk about the global economic meltdown. You know, who benefits, who doesn't? What else are you talking about? Well, I was thinking about talking about global warming, a critical issue for all of us. What else are you talking about? Well, and I thought this could be a trigger, but, you know, this is a public lecture in a public library. You know, they could come if they want to. I just didn't plan to be giving the speech in the middle of the border crossing. I said I would be talking about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What else are you talking about? And I said, well, that about does it. They're pretty big topics. And he said, you're saying you're not talking about the Olympics? The Olympics? Now, anyone who knows me, I mean, I understand, like, the World Series was between the Flyers and the Vikings and all that stuff, right? I get it. Do you still have a team called the Flyers? Yeah. Okay. So you get my speed when it comes to sports. I was completely shocked. I said, the Olympics? You mean when President Obama went to Copenhagen to try to get the Olympics in Chicago? He said, you didn't get them. I said, I know we didn't get them. He said, I'm talking about the Olympics. And I said, you mean because Brazil got them? And he said, I'm talking about the Olympics here in 2010. Oh, no, I had not planned to talk about the Olympics. So you're denying right here that you are going to address the Olympics tonight. Yep, I pretty much would say that I was not, until now, planning to talk about the Olympics. He absolutely did not believe me. I didn't understand this at all. And he told me to sit down, and they went through the car with a fine-tooth comb. I was traveling with Dennis Moynihan, my editor, and with another colleague who was driving, and they were going through their computers. They went through that car, going through our documents, our papers. I went out because I was very concerned about this, to say the least, felt deeply violated, and they told me to get back inside. And now, you know, it's more than an hour and a half late for the lecture. And they finally come inside. One was taking notes all throughout on the computer. The other was handwriting, and one of them was also reading, breaking the sound barrier, the only high point for me on the border there. And they told me to come in a back room with them. And there they took my picture. And they made four copies in the same for my two colleagues. And they stapled this document into each of our passports. And I said, I wasn't aware we needed a visa to come into Canada. And they said, these are control documents. And I opened them, and it said we were to leave the next day. We were coming on Wednesday night. We had to leave by Friday. So we got to the Vancouver Public Library very late, but, you know, now my interest was piqued. What is this obsession with the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver? It was such a violation of me personally, professionally, but also for the whole profession of journalism. It was not only a violation of, you know, freedom of the press, but of your right to know, of Canadians' right to know. Because if journalists are harassed, are detained, are monitored and surveilled, if we feel that our sources will be compromised going through documents and computers, it's going to make it more difficult for you to get information. And information is the currency of a democratic society. Information is power. So I started to ask, as we traveled now from Vancouver to Victoria, what is it about the Olympics? Oh, you know, I definitely got an earful and learned a lot that I didn't realize before. This story of our detention became the top story in Canada on CBC News. It was in the Billboard, the 6 o'clock news, and a CBC TV reporter interviewed me and showed the documents that I was handed. And it was interesting because it was followed by a piece on the Vancouver City Council. I mean, you can't not know the Olympics are taking place when you're up there. We live in a globalized world. But when it comes to getting information in this country, we are pretty insulated. there's this huge concern about the cost of the Olympics, you know, the idea that it could bankrupt Vancouver. The crackdown that's going on, which I experienced, which many others have. The Vancouver City Council was having to amend legislation. There's all sorts of policies that have been instituted, like if you have an anti-Olympic sign in your house can be raided. You're not allowed to be in the Olympics area with any kind of critical sign. And these things, there's a growing public furor across the political spectrum. And so these things are being raised. And then I started to understand. So, of course, yesterday most of our show dealt with the Olympics. Now, I don't usually have the state determining what we, you know, what we bring you on Democracy Now. But they did alert me to a major critical issue and problem in Canada. This is serious, not only in Canada, but around the world. How journalists can function, and I'll talk about that more later, but as I told the border guards, I do read the first, my first column is the last column in the book, and it is about Tommy Douglas. Well, let me share it with you. Imagine the scene, America 2009, 45,000 people have died in 1 year, an average of, oh, well over 100 a day. Who's taking them out? What's killing them? To investigate, President Obama might be tempted to call on Jack Bauer, the fictional rogue intelligence agent from the hit TV series 24. How many of you have ever seen this TV show? Well, a few more than did in Seattle. You know Jack Bauer, the tortured torturer, who invariably employs torture and a host of other illegal tactics to help the president fight terrorism. But terrorism is not the culprit here. It's lack of adequate health care. 45,000 people die a year. Lack of adequate health care. So maybe the president's solution isn't Jack Bauer, but rather the actor who plays him, who plays Jack Bauer. Yes. The star of 24 is Kiefer Sutherland, whose family has very deep connections to health care reform in Canada. That's right. You know, Kiefer Sutherland's mom is Shirley Douglas. His father is Donald Sutherland, and Shirley Douglas's father is Tommy Douglas. Tommy Douglas. Kiefer Sutherland is the grandson of Tommy Douglas, the pioneering Canadian politician credited with creating the modern Canadian healthcare system. As a youth, he almost lost his leg. His family couldn't afford treatment. The doctor said he'd treat him for free if his medical students could observe. As an adult, Tommy Douglas saw the impact of widespread poverty caused by the Great Depression. He went into politics, became the premier of Saskatchewan. He is most known for his biggest battle is the creation of universal health insurance called Medicare. It passed in the early 60s in Saskatchewan. Doctors there staged a 23-day strike led by the U.S. American Medical Association. Why? They didn't want the contagion to spread south. Despite the opposition, the Saskatchewan Medicare program was so successful and popular, it was adopted throughout Canada. While Tommy Douglas was fighting for health insurance in Canada, a similar battle was raging in the United States, resulting in the passage of Medicare and Medicaid, giving guaranteed single-payer health care to senior citizens and the poor. Now, Rush Limbaugh says 24 is one of his favorite shows. He's even visited the set. He should learn from the real-life actor who plays his hero, Jack Bauer. Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, and their cohorts may find truth, though, not as satisfying as fiction. In 2004, a Canadian Broadcasting Corporation poll named Tommy Douglas the greatest Canadian. At a protest in 2000 in Alberta, Canada, Kiefer Sutherland defended Canada's public single-payer system. Kiefer said, "Private health care does not work. America's trying to change their system. It's too expensive to get comprehensive medical care in the U.S. Why on earth are we going to follow their system here?" He said, "I consider it a humanitarian issue. This is an issue about what is right and wrong, what is decent and what is not." Maybe Jack Bauer can save the day. A few years ago, Kiefer Sutherland was interviewed by a reporter. And the reporter asked him, "How do you think you could fill your father's shoes, you know, Donald Sutherland?" And he said, "It's not my father I'm concerned about. It's my grandfather." Well, maybe if Kiefer Sutherland spoke out here, south of the border, what an effect that would have. He appeals to a wide audience, but also a very right-wing audience with 24. It's interesting that President Obama will be speaking at West Point tonight to announce the escalation of war. It was folks from West Point who appealed to Fox, 24 is a Fox program, to tone down the torture. How many soldiers were so heavily influenced by 24 when they went to Iraq and Afghanistan, the torture at Abu Ghraib, the torture at Guantanamo, the torture at Bagram? Just think, if Kiefer Sutherland were to speak out here in a very vocal way around the issue of single-payer health care, maybe he could fill his grandfather's shoes. Single-payer. How many people even in this country know what that means? Because if you watch television a lot, you probably wouldn't know. And yet, it is so easy to explain. So much easier than the thousands of pages of legislation being churned out by the House and the Senate. FAIR also did a study of the week leading up to President Obama's White House Healthcare Summit last March, where he had 120 people representing every option, except single payer, even though State Senator Obama and Senator Obama were for single payer once he became president. Well, I don't know if it's to do with the $1.4 million daily that's poured into Congress around the issue of not changing the health care system in this country by the insurance industry, by big pharma, by the drug companies, not to mention what's happening with global warming. Sure, President Obama now has announced in the last few days that he will go to the Copenhagen summit the day before he gets the Nobel Peace Prize. But it took a long time for him to say this. He said this well after he did say that there would not be a binding treaty at Copenhagen. Does that have anything to do with, or the fact the Senate is not passing binding climate change legislation that the oil, gas, and coal industries are pouring $300,000 a day into the Senate to stop any kind of legislation to reinforce the status quo? I don't know if we can afford the status quo anymore. We need campaign finance reform now. Because it's those that are in place, right, who are getting this money. And that means they have the leg up in the next round, in the next elections. But that's how the system works. And the media reinforces it. So President Obama won't have anyone at the White House Healthcare Summit, even though when polled, most people, when explaining what single payer is, are for it in the United States. Most doctors are for it. No, not the American Medical Association, but most doctors are for it. I mean, ultimately, the president was shamed because John Conyers saw him at a Congressional Black Caucus meeting, asked to come. You know, John Conyers is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. He's introduced the bill 676 every year for many years, which is a single payer bill. And the White House said, no, you can't come. But then Physicians for National Health Plans threatened to protest single-payer activists. And President Obama is sensitive to protest. After all, the community organizer-in-chief knows the power of groups making a demand. But now the community organizer-in-chief has become the commander-in-chief. The good thing is now parents all over this country will be saying to their kids, maybe you could be a community organizer, too. But that issue of making a demand now, of people taking on the mantle of community organizing as the president, as Barack Obama, the leading community organizer, has become the president, has been, I think, taken some people some time, some movements. They're trying to get their feet on the ground. What does it mean? Well, it's very significant. I think for a long time, for many years, people have felt they've been hitting their heads against a brick wall. That wall has now become a door. The door is open a crack. And the question is, will you kick it open or will it be slammed shut? His election is simply an opportunity. And will people take advantage of that opportunity? You know, the same people who are used to walking the corridors of power in Washington, used to having free run of the West Wing, used to having the ear of the most powerful person on earth, the President of the United States. When they make their demand in his ear in the Oval Office and they whisper what they want, If he can't point out the window and say, if I do that, they will storm the Bastille. If there's no one out there, he's in big trouble. And that's when you support what he does. What about when you're critical, when you feel that the country should be going in a different direction? What are you going to do? How are you going to organize? That is your challenge today. That is what makes a democracy real and vibrant. As Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. Healthcare is so important for so many people. You know, we were just traveling through California, UC Berkeley, Chico State, UCLA, UC Davis, University of California system, in the midst of the mass protests and the scores of people, mainly kids, mainly students, who were being arrested. Yes, once again, on the college campuses of this country. They were protesting because their tuition in California is being raised 32%. Massive budget cuts they're experiencing all through the system. How could it be? Look at this country. Here the president is announcing an escalation of war in Afghanistan. The wars have cost us, overall, they will cost us trillions upon trillions of dollars. Yet a poor child born in this country will not necessarily have access to health care. Most people don't realize that we are alone in the industrialized world. Again, globalized world, yet we're so insulated in this country. It's not Canada that's the exception. It's not France. It's not Britain. It's not Australia. It's not Sweden. It's the United States that is alone and not guaranteeing that basic right. I mean, you can get the boutique stuff, the boutique health care, if you want. You could pay all you want for that. But the idea that everyone has a right. In the media, immediately someone raises this issue, and it's labeled as socialist. Do we talk about the socialist military? Do we talk about the socialist firefighters? Right? Because the government, we all agree, it shouldn't just be a rich person's house that's saved, but there should be a service for everyone. Do we talk about the socialist police? Do we talk about socialist public education? You can go to private school, send your kids to private school, and that's your right. But there's a basic access to public education. Why is healthcare segmented off? Why is that the only one of these in this category that we say, no, you need money to get access? Now that issue of why it's not mentioned in the media, FAIR did that study of the week leading up to the White House healthcare summit. By the way, John Conyers did get to go, and the head of Physicians for National Health Plan did get to go after the White House said no because of the threatened protest. So that was 2 of 120. The media, that was better than what the media did. In the week leading up to the summit, the healthcare summit, FAIR looked at the major national newspapers and television networks and the stories they did on healthcare. Hundreds of stories done, which is important. It's a, you know, teaching moment. That's when we educate ourselves. Not one single-payer advocate interviewed on television. Not one. When actually, when polled, most people are for this in this country. Right? That is not a mainstream media. It's an extreme media. Someone asked me the other day, what do I think of the mainstream media? I think it would be a good idea. But back to the kids, the students who are getting arrested on college campuses today, demanding that they be able to get an education, to move on, that that's the definition of civilized society. It echoes back to 1964, Mario Savio, on the campus of UC Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, when he said, one of the leaders of the free speech movement, there comes a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, the people who own it, that unless you are free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. Healthcare, education. On the issue of healthcare, let's just talk about veterans, as President Obama will address, make this address on a military campus. On Veterans Day, we presented a study on Democracy Now! Daily, grassroots, global news hour. Many of you watch or listen. By the way, we hit 2 landmarks this year. One is we've passed 800 public radio and television stations that broadcast Democracy Now. We are extremely excited about this. We're broadcasting daily in Austria, once a week in Japan. We're broadcasting in Sweden every day. We just started in Cape Town, South Africa, and, of course, all over the world on radio as well. We translate our headlines into Spanish. We're broadcasting on over 250 stations in Latin America, in the United States, in Europe. The video is what is always so expensive. You know, the networks spend millions satelliting their video images. Now, necessity is the mother of invention. We don't have that, and have working with IT hackers, going back to, this yesterday was the, and today, the 10th anniversary of the Battle of Seattle, right? When kids, high school kids, college kids, teachers, doctors, nurses, union leaders, environmentalists took to the streets by the tens of thousands in Seattle, deeply concerned about the direction of the international financial institutions like the World Trade Organization and just what the effect of unbridled, unregulated capitalism, where it could lead us. Could you imagine 17-year-old kids? I was just in Astoria, Oregon a few days ago, and this girl came up to me, a young woman. She was 27. She said, my proudest moment was as a high school senior, I sat down on the streets of Seattle. How is it high school kids are teaching us about where we would be today? They were predicting the global economic meltdown. This is why dissent is so important. Dissent is what will save us. And it will save, among others, the vets. Harvard Medical School did this study. We had Steffi Woolhandler, a doctor at Harvard, on Veterans Day. And she presented this new study that said four times as many U.S. Army veterans died last year because they lacked health insurance than the total number of U.S. soldiers who were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan in the same period. That's astounding. Four times as many U.S. Army vets died as a result of lack of health care than soldiers died in Iraq and Afghanistan in the same period. Harvard Medical School says more than 2,200 vets under the age of 65 died in 2008 because they were uninsured. I think America can represent much better than that. Now I'd like to talk a little more about health care, but not the issue of health insurance, though that's an absolutely critical issue. At the end of August, my mom took ill. She was an incredibly vibrant, wonderful 79-year-old woman. She didn't even have a doctor because she was almost never sick. She was trekking through the mountains of New Hampshire, and she came back and she said she had a pain on her right side. The doctor said nothing to worry about, but I worry if my mother says she has a problem because she rarely complains. I called him up and urged him to check her out a little more. And he did a CAT scan and found fourth stage metastasized cancer. So in the beginning of September, we went into the hospital. I mean, my mom and my three brothers and me, all of us. That's how we saw it. We were her armed guards at the door. We were her sentries. I can't imagine someone going into the hospital today without an advocate, let alone four. And one of my brothers is in oncology at Johns Hopkins, a doctor, and we were not enough. We couldn't do what she had done for us all our lives, and that was protect her. It was remarkable. We were in one of the elite hospitals of this country, considered one of the finest, Mount Sinai in New York. It's not just the problem with lack of health insurance, though that is most important. The entire healthcare system is broken in this country. It is sick. It is in critical condition. The lack of doctors communicating with each other from department to department, the lack of real personal care. I know they're under a lot of pressure. Just a few examples of what she went through. Oh, she had been in every intensive care unit, surgical intensive care, pulmonary intensive care, medical intensive care, and then she would be moved, you know, to the general floor. And in that moving, the doctor would forget to transfer the medical regimen, you know, the drug she should be taking, the pain service, the pain medication she'd be taking. She'd just be left to flounder, to agonize, to be in pain. This is one example. She's in the hospital. The surgeon had said no food, you know, just clears. That's water, apple juice, broth, Jell-O at best. So we knew what she could have. And, yes, we were trying to control her care as best we could. It's like we were armed guards at the door with a sign that said, do no harm. So the swallow specialist comes in. And she's got yogurt in one hand and crackers in the other. I said, oh, you must have the wrong room. And she said, no, I'm testing your mother's swallowing ability. I said, yes, I know, except that my mom can't have solid food. My mother's eyes are wide. She says, what kind of yogurt is that? And the specialist says, it's blueberry yogurt. I said, oh, no. I said, she can't have solid food. She calls in the doctor, the swallow expert, and he's telling me, I have to step aside. I am not her doctor, he says. I said, it's true. I do not have a medical education, but I did graduate from elementary school. And there we learned that everything is connected and that if you eat something, it goes into your system. They made me step aside. They gave her the blueberry yogurt, and she got deathly ill. Later that day, the surgeon comes in, and because he knew we were controlling her care, he turns to me and he says, what is it about clears you don't understand? Just one small example. But the overarching issue of not being able to, when she came out of one intensive care unit, the hospital understood it was such a disaster with my mother that they were giving her a private room, you know, somehow to give back. And my mother hears a nurse say, we're putting her in a private room. And here, she's in intensive care. Most people are unconscious. They're all anesthetized, right? And she hears private room, and she yells across the intensive care unit, not if Medicare doesn't pay for it. I said, Ma, don't worry. I think this is making up for something. And she said, well, no, there's another reason I don't want to have a private room. She said, because if I have a roommate, there's twice the chance someone might walk in at some point to help us. She came out of surgery one day. She was lying in the recovery room. We were all around her, and the doctor was there. Again, everyone unconscious but Mom. And she is whispering, 3,000, 3,000. 3,000 what, Mom? The doctor says, 3,000 what, Mrs. Goodman? She says, the Chinese figured out pain management 3,000 years ago. Why haven't you figured it out yet? So I'm sitting near her in the hospital one day. I would go from the hospital to the show in the morning, and we'd do that, and then I'd come back and just be. We were afraid to leave her 4 minutes. We at first didn't sleep overnight there, but then we saw some of the worst crises occurred in the middle of the night, so we had to be there all the time. It helped when, in the midst of that, Michael Moore came out with Capitalism, A Love Story. So he came to the studio to do the show. Oh, that was the other landmark we passed, by the way, studio. You know, we broadcast out of a firehouse studio, 100-year-old landmark building. We've just moved. And tomorrow is the hard launch. Monday was the soft launch of our new studio. We've transforming an old printing press floor, 10,000 square foot in Manhattan, into a modern-day digital internet radio TV studio. It will be the greenest internet radio TV studio in the country, deeply believing in sustainability. There we hope to train the next generation of independent journalists and to translate the show into a number of languages. We're not far from the United Nations. Translators can come over before they work at the UN, and we can simultaneously translate the show into Spanish and other languages and really get it out there all over the world, a true daily, grassroots, global, unembedded, independent, international news hour. We believe it's independent media that will save all of us. The media are the most powerful institutions on earth, more powerful than any bomb, more powerful than any missile, is an idea that explodes into your consciousness, that shatters a paradigm, a different way of looking at something that you'd never thought of. And the media, how often you learn from the media, actually it's not very often these days, but how often you could. We need people who think outside the box. Think of that box as your TV screen. Otherwise, inside the box, as we see every day, that small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong, what are they doing? In that 8-second soundbite, they're only reinforcing the status quo, and we can't afford the status quo anymore, from global warming to global warming to the global economic meltdown to health care. And even with the 8-second soundbite constraint, where if they say if you take more than 8 seconds, you're not ready for prime time, think how easy it would be to explain single payer. 1/1,000, 2/1,000, 3, the seconds, right? Could we do it in 8 seconds? Single payer? Lower the age of eligibility for Medicare to the day you're born. And everyone understands that. Every reference within that. Lower the age of Medicare eligibility to the day you are born. It's not even radical or revolutionary. We already have the system. It's just a bureaucratic tinkering with the numbers, with the age. And yet you almost never hear this on television. Back to healthcare and back to Mount Sinai. So it was just getting increasingly impossible as my mom got sicker and sicker. I mean, the little things, you know, trying to diagnose what she had and the hospital sending out the tissue samples to the wrong address and then sending out the wrong tissue samples. It just went on like this. But it wasn't until I was sitting reading this op-ed piece in the New York Times in the hospital. You know, on the op-ed page, how they have that corner, it's actually an ad. It was pioneered by like Exxon or Mobil or now Exxon Mobil, where, it looks like an editorial, but it's actually an advertisement. It's really just corporate propaganda. And this was an ad for a hospital, and it was written by a woman named Dr. Diane Meyer. And it said the two things patients need most are time with their doctor. I mean, the doctors were moonwalking out of the room before they even made it in, it seemed. And they would do it at 5:30 in the morning before the family is there, they hope, or whatever. Before the patient comes to consciousness, if you were totally healthy, you could hardly describe when you're just being woken up what you're feeling, let alone if you are sick. And the other thing, Dr. Meyer wrote, is that patients need pain management. Pain makes you sicker. But what does it take to deal with pain? First, it's knowing the patient. It's looking into their eyes. It's taking the time to see how they're doing. Now, I know there are many great doctors. My dad was a doctor. He was an ophthalmologist and an eye surgeon. I used to get on him all the time when I was growing up because he was famous in our community for if you go to Dr. Goodman's office, you'll wait about 3 or 4 hours, maybe 5. And I said, Dad, you got to respect the patient's time. This is terrible. I said, why don't you just make your appointments further apart? They were every 20 minutes. He said, I can't be in this practice if I do that. That's the rule, every 20 minutes. But people would wait because they knew. And he would spend an hour, sometimes two, with one patient or a patient's family. He'd learn their whole history. He was so engrossed. But as they're telling him their story, and he's asking how are the kids and the grandchildren, he is looking in their eyes. He's an eye doctor. And he's seeing how they're doing, and he's looking at the kids and saying, what do you want to be when you grow up? But he's looking at them. That is a doctor for the whole being, the whole person. That's why people waited. And I had it wrong. It showed his ultimate respect for his patients. So back to Mom in the hospital. Pain management and time with your doctor. I read this, I say, Mom, we're going to this doctor's hospital. The problem was it was Mount Sinai. We were in it. We got in touch with Dr. Meyer then, and she changed our experience for the last few weeks, taught us in the last few weeks of my mother's life as she was slipping away how to say goodbye. How to have those conversations, experiences we certainly don't have very much as families, and I don't think even medical students are trained to deal at all. How often do they have a class? She's a pioneer in the palliative care movement in this country. And she said there are five things you want to say. Thank you. Forgive me. I forgive you. I love you. And goodbye. And then how to deal with her friends, who really were her family. So many people wanted to come. I'm so glad my aunt and uncle got to be with her in the last days of her life. Her friends were clamoring at the door, and we didn't want to be the gatekeepers. We knew how dear they were to her, but she was so sick. And Dr. Meyer said, have them write letters, you know, not get well soon, but about their experiences with her, about how they feel about her. And we sat at her bedside and read these emails and letters. It was so beautiful. She'd say, read that second paragraph again. Or, is that what he thought when that happened? And we came to see her in a whole different way through the eyes of her friends, to experience that, not afterwards, but with her, so that we could ask her about it and ask her about what these relationships meant. And then the grandchildren. Do you bring the grandchildren to the hospital? You know, they loved her so much. She was so involved with their lives. But is this the memory you want them to have of her? But my mom was radiant. She was transcendent to the end. And we decided, yes. So David, who I write the books with, who lives in Vermont with his wife Sue and Jasper 10 and Ariel 17, he brought them. Jasper was insistent. I need to see my Ima now. He would sit at lunchtime, because David was with us in the hospital, at the lunch table outside, and he wouldn't play with the other kids. His other grandfather is also very sick. And then David got him finally at least to sit on a swing at lunchtime. And he came with Ariel. And Ariel read my mom a letter about what she had meant to her. And Jasper, holding her hand, just said, I love you. And then Steve brought his three children. Anna, who just graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, she's 23 and she's going to go to medical school. She has a wonderful voice. She was in the Penny Loafers here. And she sang Full Throttle in the midst of the hospital, holding her grandmother's hand at last. Sarah's 12, Eli is 11, and Eli composed a symphony for her on his computer, and he sat next to her, and he played it. And my mother told them, well, she started as usual, because even in the last days, what'd you do today? What happened with your test? You know, she made it clear she'd be with Ariel, a soccer star, her cheerleader right there, wherever she plays. And Jasper, Red Sox fan, always coming down from Vermont to Fenway Park, she'd be sitting with him in the stadium. Sarah, she'll be with her at her bat mitzvah May 8th in Baltimore. Anna, she'll be with her on Grand Rounds someday. And so I read at the funeral, I think, what my mother was conveying to them. A poem that you may well know, that I also read at my father's funeral 10 years ago. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am 1,000 winds that blow. I am the diamond glints on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain, on the gentle autumn rain. When you awaken in the morning's hush, I am the swift uplifting rush of quiet birds in circling flight. I am the soft star that shines at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. My mother was a wonderful woman. She taught women's history and literature at community colleges, and Long Island, where we grew up. She taught me about feminism. She'd teach cops and firefighters, civil servants, who, if they got more credit, they would get a higher salary. And, you know, when they're signing up and they have the choice of classes, what could be easier than some chick lit, you know, like some women's literature? So they'd come into class, and she'd introduce them to Toni Morrison. She'd introduce them to Virginia Woolf. And soon the cop would bring his wife and the firefighter, his daughter, that little baby he loved so much, who'd somehow grown into a young woman he couldn't begin to understand. And these classes would swell. By the end of semester, sometimes they'd have whole families in them. And so my mother went back to school and went into social work, clinical social work, because she wanted to work with families and couples and individuals in a different way. She, like my dad, was intensely curious. This is what they infected us with, me and my brothers. I mean, books were the wallpaper of our house. The library was at the end of our block where we were growing up. It was our living room. My dad sat on the library board for 25 years. These remarkable sanctuaries of dissent. For my father, a trip into New York just to go to a bookstore was the biggest thing for him. When we had a car stolen, they came to see me in Manhattan one day for dinner. We came out and the car wasn't there anymore. We went to the police station, had they towed it, a cab took us to every tow lot. No, just seemed to be stolen. So the cab drives us to the Long Island Railroad. And as we're going inside, as I'm letting them off to take the train home, the only thing my dad said to my mom, honey, was my book in that car? They go inside. I mean, it was like $4.99, some dog-eared paperback. And when they get out, the cab driver says, I don't think I have ever. That's his only reaction. A few days later, they find the car in a known drug location in Brooklyn. My father's first question to my mother, did they find the book? Ask the police if they found the book in the front of the car. Their intense interest in literature, in documentary, in film, in the world. They were intrepid travelers. My mother, beyond when my father died, traveled the world. She went to Iran. She went to Turkey. She went to New Orleans after the storm. She went to Israel. She went to Palestine. She went to Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos. She went to China. And when she went, my parents went to Israel a number of times. You know, my parents met at a Hebrew-speaking camp. They weren't allowed to speak English. And they went to camp with Noam and Carol Chomsky. You know, Noam and Carol from right here in Philadelphia. Noam and Carol knew each other since they were 2 years old. My mother, to show how complex she was, she won funniest camper 1 year. And the next year, she won most serious camper. Oh, just about out of time. So when she went to Palestine, that was particularly significant, the occupied territories. She had a journalist sense. She wanted to see the occupied territories with her own eyes. And she went with a tour group, a human rights delegation led by a Palestinian tour guide. And as they went, I don't know if it was Bethlehem or Jericho. I can't even ask her now. But the tour guide, they tried to go through. That had been a deal worked out. They go through the soldiers. But when that tour guide, the Palestinian, went up to the soldiers, he said no. And that's when my mother walked up to the checkpoint. You know, she spoke a kind of classical Hebrew. She'd learned it many decades ago with my dad. I think it's equivalent to Shakespearean English. And I don't know exactly what she said to these soldiers who could have been her grandchildren. But she said, you will part the ways. And they separated. And the whole tour group went through. And that Palestinian tour guide put his arm around my mother wide-eyed and said, I'm sticking with you. And that has been my philosophy all of my life. I tried that, parting the ways, up at the Canadian border. It didn't work. And just a few last thoughts, as I think I have, my time is up. And by the way, I look forward to signing books upstairs. If you get to, remember it's the holidays, you might want to give one to a library or high school or whatever, or family members, or your favorite Border Patrol. you get a wonderful DVD of a speech of Bill Moyers. And, you know, Bill just announced that he's retiring in April from PBS. And he wrote a wonderful introduction to Breaking the Sound Barrier about the importance of independent media. But the backdrop of my parents' lives, I mean, my mom grew up poor. Her father was an Orthodox rabbi in Brooklyn. He ran a local yeshiva. He was the principal. And in the summer, they'd go to this bungalow colony to get out of the summer heat. And my mom, I always thought of it when I was growing up, as she described it, as this black cloud that descended over the colony. But she was out playing one day, and she heard this wail that went up, and it was her mother, my grandmother, who had received a letter that members of her family had died in the Holocaust. That was the backdrop of our lives, the Holocaust, the loss, the catastrophe of the Holocaust. My parents taught us that the motto that came out of that was much more than a motto. It was a credo, and it was never again for anyone, anywhere. Never again. A few days before my mom died, I had the honor of being able to give her the first bound copy of Breaking the Sound Barrier, and I opened it to the dedication page, and it said, "To my mother, Dari Goodman, the most remarkable woman I have ever known." I'm just going to end with the first column, which takes place at the UN, the UN Security Council. And it's very much inspired by my mom and dad and what they taught us. No, they weren't journalists, but they had that instinct, which was see things how they are, and then you can do something about it. They protected us in a cocoon our whole lives, but they never said we should stay in that cocoon, that we should go out and make a difference in the world. Perhaps if we could possibly make the whole world that cocoon, we could come home and retreat into that very warm, safe place. But our job was to go out. At the UN Security Council, right before the invasion of Iraq, a tapestry hung outside the UN Security Council that is a replica of Pablo Picasso's Guernica. That is the Spanish town that was bombed during the Franco years, that shows the agony of war, the pain in the faces of the animals and the humans. It's become an anti-war symbol around the world, and it was there that Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, would give his pro-war pronouncement or other U.S. officials or Western leaders. And it wasn't, the irony wasn't lost on the UN or the U.S., and so they shrouded the tapestry. They covered it with a blue curtain. It's our job to pull that curtain back, to see what is happening, so we can do something about it. As President Obama gives his speech tonight, escalating the war in Afghanistan, think about what would happen in this country if we had a media that told the truth, that laid things out as they are so that you could decide what to do. I dare say if for just 1 week in this country, the surviving newspapers had the photographs and the top stories, the top network newscasts began with the images of war, the babies dead on the ground, the women with their legs blown off by drones from Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq, the soldiers dead and dying for just 1 week. Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. Democracy Now.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.